It may be the week for letting go. Abdullah Abdullah says he's dropping out of the presidential race in Afghanistan.
I repeat it once again that I will not participate in the November 7th elections.
And in New York, Republican Didi Scozzafava has dropped out of the race for Congress.
It was time today, I think, to do the right thing, which is to release the Republican county chairs and let them do what's best for the Republican Party.
And I don't know, is this the part where we let go?
Letting go and letting the voters down, or walking away from an unwinnable argument? Sometimes there's just no clean breaks on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 2nd. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good
feeling
morning,
better?
Celeste. Feeling much, much better. A little frog in the throat, though. Also on the program, we look at the agenda for the week, including the options now that Hamid Karzai is officially the next and former president of Afghanistan. It's an all-Yankees-Vikings Monday morning in sports. And Daddy Dearest, when father's wanting to help, feels more like work for mom. Family turf battles this morning.
But first, Brian Mann joins us. He's a reporter for North Country Public Radio. So, Brian, why did Republican Didi Scozzafava pull out of the congressional race in New York?
This is a moderate Republican. She's pro-choice, supports same-sex marriage. She was absolutely gobsmacked by the National Tea Party movement. Guys like Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Dick Armey, they piled in, backed a third-party conservative with massive amounts of cash and just shredded her campaign. So she's out.
I especially get extra points for the use of the word gobsmack.
Gobsmack
Brian
shredding.
He's with us. We're going to talk with you more in a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, Hamid Karzai has been declared the winner of Afghanistan's, now we learn, uncontested presidential election. The announcement came this morning from Afghanistan's Electoral Commission. It canceled the runoff election scheduled for later this week because the main opposition candidate, Abdullah Abdullah, pulled out of the race over the weekend. In economic news, the Ford Motor Company announced this morning that it made nearly $1 billion in the third quarter. Ford says it now expects to be solidly profitable in 2011.
Meanwhile, the lender CIT Group has filed for bankruptcy. Bondholders have agreed to a reorganization plan that will reduce CIT's debt while allowing it to go on operating. In baseball, the Yankees beat the Phillies 7-4 last night to win Game 4 of the World Series. They now lead the series 3-1. The Yankees could clinch the World Series title tonight in Philadelphia if they win there. In Washington, President Obama meets today with his economic advisory board to talk about job creation.
And the bad week on Wall Street, I would imagine. Last week was awful.
Yeah, well, yeah. All major indices went down about 2.5% as of Friday at close. Dow is going to open at 97.13. The S&P opens at 1,036 and NASDAQ is kicking off at 2045. But tomorrow is election day, as we've been talking about, and we're wondering what is the big issue for you wherever you're going to be voting.
My name is Craig. I'm calling from Hoboken. Tomorrow and Tuesday the 3rd, I'm voting for my pension. School teacher, public school teacher, and I'm going to resign because my pension is voting my own interest.
That would be the governor's race in New Jersey. What's bringing you to the polls tomorrow? What's the big issue? The economy, war, health care, school board is
school
actually
millage.
A lot. Actually, school yeah, that
election.
Brings a lot
Those
of people to the polls.
Yep.
8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning. Three key elections tomorrow in New York, New Jersey, and Virginia. But you know, John, it's not the, I mean, like we have a gay marriage issue on the ballot in Maine. There's actually, even though this is an off-year election, we could see a relatively large turnout.
Well, you often have in off-year elections symbolic contests, either symbolic in terms of issues like the Maine contest for national trends, or symbolic like the New Jersey governor's race, which is symbolic for Obama's coattails. We'll see what that means.
Right. Well, in New York, Didi Scozzafava made more than a symbolic move. Moderate Republican Didi Scozzafava has dropped out of the special congressional election in New York. She says she's leaving the race because she'd been outspent on both sides, and then shocked everybody with the person she's endorsing. Brian Mann rejoins us, a reporter with North Country Public Radio in New York. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Who did she? She's a moderate Republican, as you said, and she left the race and endorsed who?
She's endorsing Bill Owens, who's a Democrat. He's, you know, a Democrat who's tied himself very closely to Barack Obama. And so, yeah, I think Scozzafava's decision to back him yesterday really sent shockwaves through this race here. It's a development that no one expected.
Amazing.
It must be tied, perhaps, to how bitter she feels. This is sound of a Skozafava who you interviewed reacting to those ads, conservative ads that she called divisive and hateful.
Some of the ads that they're currently airing are very insensitive to people, to families. I just feel that type of divisiveness, kind of hateful leadership, that is never going to build a stronger party.
And she's not talking about Democrats with their divisive ads. She's talking about her own party.
Yeah, she really characterizes this as a battle for the soul of the Republican Party and the movement. Can there be moderates like her? Can people like her continue to work in districts like this one in New York State? Or in the future, will you see this massive national conservative movement come in with kind of a litmus test, kind of a list of issues, and say, look, she's just not one of us. We're going to blow her out of the water. And here, at least, they managed to do it in good fashion.
Well, Brian Mann, this is a tiger of a political story up there in the North Country of New York. And I'm wondering how the local GOP is sitting with this tidal wave which came in. I mean, they wanted Skozafava to begin with.
They did, and they thought she was the best person to win, and I think there was initially a lot of resentment. You know, Doug Hoffman, the conservative candidate who's sort of standing still in this race, he had been rejected by these county leaders and sent packing, and then he waded back in as a third-party candidate. But now, you know, a lot of these Republicans are pivoting, and you even saw, you know, former New York Governor George Pataki jumping in and saying, I'm a Doug Hoffman man last week. You know, people are trying to sort of figure out where the Republican Party is going to be, you know, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years from now. It's very shifting and dangerous sand. So I think a lot of people are jumping on board. I think the question for Republicans is what happens to those moderate Republicans, especially women, who look at these very conservative kind of almost southern social values and wonder, you know, will this continue to play in New England and the Northeast?
Now, to speak to that, here's President Obama's campaign manager from the presidential election speaking on Meet the Press on Sunday.
Sarah Palin, the other Republican candidates who are likely to run, the Limbaughs and Becks of the world, are basically hanging a moderates need not apply sign outside the Republican National Committee headquarters. And for a party that has historic lows right now, because centrists and moderates are leaving them in droves, have catastrophic problems with younger voters, Hispanic voters, and African Americans. It's a very curious strategy to kind of repair this damage.
Is this what you're hearing? Are the conservatives basically backing Doug Hoffman? Or is this, I mean, is it an actual split between conservatives and Republicans in New York?
No, it's a split on the level of bloodbath. I mean, there's absolute rage here between these two wings of the Republican conservative movement. And I think one of the things that's going to drive where that story goes is whether Doug Hoffman can win. If he prevails tomorrow, which it looks very possible that he might, you'll have these conservatives going back to the establishment leadership in Washington, D.C. and saying, look, you have to follow our lead, the Sarah Palin direction of the party, the Rush Limbaugh direction of the party. That's where it's at. You know, but you have other people, including Newt Gingrich, who say, no, we've got to leave some room for the Skozafavas to operate. So, yeah, this is a very alive and very bloody conversation is the nicest word you can put on it.
Well, I imagine you're going to be very busy tomorrow, Brian Mann. Brian Mann is a reporter for North Country Public Radio. He joined us from New York. And we're going to move on now into governor's races, actually. We have governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey that people are watching. And we're joined now by Bob Henley. He's covering the New Jersey governor's race for New York Public Radio. And Bob, President Obama was actually in Newark, New Jersey yesterday. And President Obama has actually been really supporting John Corzine.
When I ran for election, I did not say this was going to come overnight. I didn't say this was going to be easy. I didn't say you were going to be able to just put your feet up and turn on the TV and kind of watch everything magically get better. Change is hard.
Bob, this is the third time the president has traveled to New Jersey to campaign for Governor John Corzine. I assume that means that Corzine is in trouble and he needs that kind of firepower.
It means that President Obama got 2.2 million votes just a year ago, which was something unthinkable for a Democrat in New Jersey, just in terms of the scale. And everyone who's been following this for a few decades figures that this is shaping up to be like the 1993 contest with Governor Florio and a newcomer, Whitman, at that time. And Whitman won by 26,000 votes, the Republican.
Wow.
Very close.
And
that was very close. And people, Democrats, in fact, including Corzine, tries to allude historically to what happened then as he remembers it. That set into motion with the victory in Virginia, which we may see for Republicans on Tuesday, and the victory in New Jersey. He believes that sets the stage for the return of Newt Gingrich. The question is Barack Obama leading a conventional political movement or a social movement? And that's what he was trying to invoke yesterday, getting people to turn out and flex some of that muscle that he demonstrated in 2008.
Well, it looks like we also have Daggett as the third party candidate who's splitting up a little bit of the moderate vote.
Well, and it's back to Republicans, Dungeons and Dragons, because Chris Daggett was a DEP commissioner under moderate Tom Kaine, the governor. And at one point, the Republican Governors Association, looming very large in this contest, spent quite a bit of money actually going after Daggett and Corzine, inadvertently showing Chris Daggett's picture to more New Jersey people than Daggett as an independent could ever afford to reach. And so there's that subtext going on here, but from the left in terms of what's going on with the Republican Party.
Okay, Bob Henley is a reporter for New York Public Radio. We have, as Bob Henley referred to, we have another race, governor's race, that we're watching right now, and that is in Virginia. And we're joined now by Robert McCartney. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, Celeste.
We just talked about this really close race in New Jersey, but the race for governor of Virginia is not close. How is that race shaping up?
Not close at all. The Republican Bob McDonnell is ahead in all the polls, most recently by double digits. The average was, I think, 15 points. He was ahead by 15 points over the Democrat Cree Deeds.
So this is kind of, is everyone assuming this is a done deal?
I think most people are assuming it's a done deal. The Democrat Deeds is saying that if they get a big turnout, if they can energize those Obama voters who put Virginia in the Democratic column last year in a presidential race for the first time since 1964, if they can energize those people, then maybe they could have a miracle comeback victory. But I think most political experts and observers think that not only that McDonnell will win, but they could well be a sweep of all three statewide offices, governor, lieutenant governor, and state attorney general.
So what do we extract from the Virginia situation that's local, and what is a national trend? We're certainly talking about this New York race as an indication of some sort of strategy certain members of the GOP might use as we get into the 2012 period of skewing more conservative. What do you see in Virginia there, Robert?
Well, the exact opposite, John. It's very interesting. The contrast between what's going on in Virginia and what's going on in that upstate New York congressional race could not be starker. In Virginia, Bob McDonnell, who has his roots in the social conservative movement, who went to Pat Robertson's university and got his origins in the Republican Party as a Christian conservative, openly Christian conservative, pushing social issues, he has run a campaign that looks set to sweep to victory by positioning himself as a moderate, by emphasizing jobs, by emphasizing low taxes, by emphasizing mainstream issues, help on transportation, help on education, and really downplaying the social conservative views that originally put him in politics. And the message for Republicans in Virginia seems very clear: to run as a moderate and bring back to the Republican fold the independent voters, and especially fiscally conservative, socially moderate voters whom they lost to Obama and, in fact, lost to the Democrats in the last two gubernatorial races in Virginia.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to do in New York, and that hasn't worked out so well. Robert McCartney is a columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Well, three data points there, elections we're looking at in three places around the country, but it is election day tomorrow everywhere. What's the local issue that's moving you to the polls at 877-8-MY-TAKE? Tell us your story, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You can do a little campaigning. I guess polls will be open tomorrow. We'll put your campaign ads on the air. Keep them short.
No negative campaigning.
No.
Hey, you want that to go?
We're lining up some takeouts for stories we want you to be on top of this week, and we're going to start with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. The Congressional Budget Office says that for all of this arguing about the public option in the health care reform debate, the CBO says only 2% of people are expected to actually use any public option if it exists. Todd, now that seems to be the headline this morning.
Yeah, that's right. That might affect the health care debate this week. By the way, the Democrats in the House plan to try to get their big health care bill on the floor by the end of the week, by Friday probably. Leadership has already warned members to be prepared to be in Washington and voting over the weekend next weekend. So they're planning on having this debate. You mentioned the Congressional Budget Office. Yeah, 2% of Americans would sign up for the public option. That's the estimate. And really, it's very interesting because on one hand, you know, it negates the argument that this is a giant government takeover of healthcare, right? 2% of people are using it. On the other hand, it negates the argument that this provides any meaningful competition to private insurers. So both arguments on both sides of this ideologically seem to be undermined, and it sort of starts to make you wonder whether the public option in its current form, this negotiated rate form, has any real use at all, right, unless you believe it's just the camel's nose under the tent to get a government takeover of healthcare later, which maybe it is.
Very quickly, the CBO has been asked to assess cost. Did they assess a cost of this 2% participation?
A cost of it?
Yeah, is it billions and billions and billions? I mean, is it an expensive 2% or kind of a non-starter?
Well, like the Senate bill, the bill is basically deficit neutral over 10 years, which means after 10 years, it actually reduces the deficit by a small amount, $9 billion, which in Washington, you know, $9 billion is you buy a cup of coffee with that.
All right, very quickly, some leaks and revelations over the weekend of ethics committee documents suggesting that some lawmakers have some problems they have to deal with.
Yeah, basically a security breach from the House Ethics Committee. You know, they do their business in secret, and there's a reason. They investigate a lot of people. Most of those investigations usually come to nothing. Good government people want them to be more open. Well, a document got leaked, and just to bring people up to speed real quickly, there are nearly 30 House members under investigation. Many of these were known. The biggest one is investigation of Pennsylvania Congressman Jack Murtha, a very powerful appropriator, his ties to a lobbying group who he was steering projects to. What we did learn from that is that investigation goes a lot deeper than Murtha. Mm. There are 7 members of his appropriation subcommittee, Republicans and Democrats, involved. So people are going to be watching that. And John, the last thing I'll tell you real quickly. People on the Hill are a little bit disappointed from the news from the New York 23rd because people do love to say Scazafava in Washington, and we're not gonna get to say
congressional race we talked about earlier this morning. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent from Washington. Thanks.
And now we're gonna go to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. If you thought that Madoff going to jail was the last we'd hear of Bernie Madoff, you were wrong. So what we're hearing now, Louise, if I get this right, is that from these documents the SEC has released, not only was it ridiculous that they didn't catch him at the time, but after they interviewed him, he kind of was hoping he was going to get caught earlier. Is this all correct?
That's right. He did a jailhouse interview. The inspector general of the SEC went into the jail in June and interviewed him, and he almost complained about how the SEC missed this. For instance, he was talking about this 2006 inspection where they came in and he says they really could have caught him, that it would not have been difficult to catch him.
It was clear. Completely clear.
And then he says afterwards they sent him a letter with a couple of violations and he says to himself, what the heck? Are you guys nuts with this nitpicking? After 2 months, they found 2 to 3 nitpicky things, and they were wrong about those things. Like, he was insulted they didn't catch him.
He's probably saying, you could have saved me a lot of trouble if you just caught me about a decade ago, right?
Well, he did say, he said, literally, I wish they caught me 6 years ago, 8 years ago.
Because there would have been less money involved and less damage, right?
He didn't explain in here why he wished that. He did in here talk a lot about the nightmare he had been living, and so maybe he just, you know, had wanted to get out of this nightmare, but he said he wished they had caught him.
So the SEC is a watchdog, kind of more like a toy poodle, right?
Well, what he had to say about the SEC was not flattering either. He said, look, these guys aren't rocket scientists. That's the problem. And he also talked about how he was friends with so many high officials at the SEC and at other financial areas, agencies. For instance, he said he knew Leavitt very well. He was a former commissioner
Arthur
of the SEC.
Leavitt, sure.
Mm-hmm. And then he talked about Mary Shapiro, who is the current head of the SEC, and she's the one who's got to go in there and turn this agency around. And he said she was a dear friend, and he said, she probably thinks, I wish I never knew this guy. Because they were friends, and, you know, Yeah. Now she's got to crack down there.
Okay, well, I assume that we're going to hear about changes at the SEC. That's Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times.
All right, a memo to John Huckenberry. Do not speak about the University of Oregon with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen with our last takeout for this segment. Takeaway sports contributor, if you stayed up last night and you were a Yankees fan, boy, you had a smile on your face this morning, right, Ibrahim?
Without a doubt. Let's go to my buddy DJ Chaz O.
Think about each team compared to the Yankee teams of past. As talented as this lineup is that they feel that the sum is greater than the individual parts of this lineup. And that's what's going to win them the championship.
So DJ Chaz is very happy about the 7-4 victory over Philadelphia.
Without a doubt. And so where were you at 11-11 last night? Because that's when the score was... That's what the score was, 4-3. Yankees were in the lead. Jabba Chamberlain on the mound against Yankee record Jason Worth. He's tall. He's lanky. He's the super athlete, the kind of athlete the Giants could have used when they lost to the Eagles 40-17.
Right, yeah, that's another story.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
But Worth has been huge in this series.
He has. He hit two home runs two nights ago. But here comes Jabba Chamberlain, strikes him out. Bam. Raul Ibañez strikes him out. Then next up is Pedro Feliz. He hits a home run. The score is tied 4-4. We go to the top of the ninth, and that's when the Yankees took control. Hideki Matsui struck out. Jeter struck out. And then who comes up? Johnny Damon with a 9-pitch at-bat. Johnny Damon hits a single. Then he steals second. Oh. And then he steals third. And that puts Brad Lidge on the hot seat on the mound for the Phillies. And that's where it all unraveled. And who came up to bat? A-Rod.
Well, let's talk about Damon for a moment.
Correct.
I mean, he is playing like his contract is up.
That's a good point. Well, 2004, Johnny Damon was the ultimate Yankee killer. He broke the curse of the Bambino
with
the Red Sox. He hit the grand slam in the ALCS in 2004. This is the Johnny Damon that the Yankees needed when they picked him up back then.
One more game, and 3-1. The Yanks have a chance to win the series in the next game.
Without a doubt.
All right. The next game is in Philadelphia. It's tonight at 8 o'clock, quickly on the New York Marathon.
Well, we have the first American in 27 years, Meb Keflezighi, who wins the marathon for the United States. He's a immigrant from Eritrea, but he wrapped himself in the American flag. He's the best expression of the American dream that you'll see right now in running.
All right, you were texting me about that one last night. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. There's your takeouts.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we're going to hit the agenda this week and take a look at what's unfolding in the next couple of days. But first, let's check in on top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Hamid Karzai will be Afghanistan's president for another term. The country's election commission declared him the winner after canceling this week's presidential runoff election over the weekend. The main challenger in the race, Abdullah Abdullah, dropped out. In neighboring Pakistan, at least 30 people are dead after an explosion in the city of Rawalpindi. The suicide bombing targeted civilians. And back home, the Ford Motor Company has some good news.
They are. They just announced this morning they made nearly $1 billion in the third quarter. They expect to be solidly profitable, they say, by 2011. But I'd say $1 billion is solidly profitable. Meanwhile, the lender CIT Group has filed for bankruptcy. Bondholders have agreed to a reorganization plan that will reduce CIT's debt while allowing it to go on operating. President Obama spent yesterday in New Jersey to support Governor John Corzine in his race for re-election. He's up against Republican Chris Christie. It's one of many elections taking place around the country tomorrow. And Pentagon auditors have told a main contractor in Iraq to cut its workforce there. Otherwise, the company will face nearly $200 million in penalties. Auditors say the contractor, KBR, has increased employee levels in Iraq, even though U.S. forces are leaving. KBR says it disagrees with the results of the audit. And in sports, as we've been talking about all morning, the Yankees are one win away from clinching the World Series title. They beat the Phillies 7-4. Last night to win game four, and they lead the series 3-1. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Hey, what's happening?
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
So, good morning, everyone. Certainly driving the agenda is a story we reported this morning. President Hamid Karzai is officially the president of Afghanistan.
We declare that Mr. Hamid Karzai, which got the majority votes in the first round, and he is the only candidate for the second round of elections of Afghanistan in 2009. be declared as elected president of Afghanistan.
That announcement from the Election Commission in Afghanistan comes after Abdullah Abdullah, the former foreign minister, withdrew from the runoff election. Hamid Karzai officially the president for a second term. To take a closer look, we spoke earlier with Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Adam Minot. He's the world affairs correspondent with our partner, the BBC. The Hamid Karzai government had a legitimacy problem before this happened, and I asked Adam where this stands now.
I don't think this is going to make it any easier, because we're now obviously going to get Hamid Karzai remaining as president for another term, another 5 years. But I think people are going to say, well, is he there legitimately? In the first round of voting, he got fewer than the 50% of votes required to automatically become president again for another term. So I think people are going to ask, well, is he really the man who should be sitting in the president's seat? And I think there's also a danger that the Taliban will claim that this is a victory for them. They have effectively destroyed the electoral process in Afghanistan.
Marcus Mabry, so the Obama administration now suddenly has to fast track its efforts to come up with a strategy in Afghanistan and to decide about a troop increase or not, right?
Well, I think in the short term, the administration is going to say, well, you know, we expect an election on Saturday, so we're not going to all of a sudden come up with our announcement of our strategy this week just because the election's not going to take place on Saturday. I think the administration, you know, in the next 2 to 4 weeks anyway, would have made the announcement of their plan. And I think in the end, it's probably going to be a kind of a split the difference. Probably not as many troops increase as General McChrystal would like, but certainly not a drawdown. Probably an increase of some American troops.
And if you listen to the voices from the administration yesterday, you could barely suppress a yawn into their reaction to all of this. Here's Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod speaking on the television shows over the weekend.
We don't think that it's going to add a complication to the strategy. It's up to the Afghan people and their authorities to decide how to proceed going forward.
I expect the president will make a decision within weeks. As you know, he's gone through a very rigorous process.
No hurry there.
Well, you know, not only that, but, you know, you really believe they think that it makes no difference. You know, of course it makes a difference. Of course it complicates matters. And, of course, to have a government without legitimacy is a bad thing. We're talking about your ally in time of war.
There's a legitimacy question over in Iran, and there's a pretty important anniversary that passes this week, the anniversary of the taking of the hostages in Iran. There are demonstrations called for in Iran. The Ahmadinejad government has legitimacy problems. Will the administration step up and point fingers here or keep in the back?
Unlikely. You know, we weren't expecting the chaos that happened in June around that electoral process in Iran and the violence that happened there. We hadn't seen it before from this regime, taking, you know, young people in the streets. We don't expect it again this week. We could be wrong again. But on the 30th anniversary, which will happen on Wednesday, we'll have massive anti-American marches. You always do. This is a big anniversary for the Islamic Revolution there, so you'll have even bigger ones. But the opposition has called for its own marches against the regime. And their argument is this regime is not legitimate. This regime is not really the inheritors of the spirit of liberation that was supposed to be the Islamic Revolution in Iran, that they are. And so that's going to be an interesting clash to watch.
Today, White House Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers will lead a high-level meeting to discuss the state of the economy. Last week, we learned the U.S. economy is no longer contracting. By the end of the week, we're going to learn about jobs figures. Around the world, Adam Minot, BBC World Affairs correspondent, does the world blame the U.S. for the recession, and is it looking for U.S. action to pull the rest of the world out of it?
I think initially there was some blame cast at the U.S., but I think now there is a recognition that without the recent U.S. action, that the recession would be a lot worse and may well have fallen into a depression. I mean, similar position here in Europe. We've got Germany and France climbing out of recession. Not true here in the U.K. We are technically still shrinking here in London. But I think that there is a feeling that the tide has turned. Whether this is a real turn or whether it's a blip, I think we're only going to know in the coming months.
Well, there's a blip coming up, and here's Timothy Geithner talking about it over the weekend.
Don't know for sure, but it's likely still rising, and it's probably going to rise further before it starts to come down again.
Double digits?
Most economists think we'll probably get there.
That's Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary, talking about the unemployment rate, which will be announced on Friday, expected possibly to hit double digits. At what point, Marcus Mabry, does the Obama administration own this recession and the economic downturn and the consequences?
I think they own it now. They might argue that's unfair. They've only been in office for 8 months. This is a George W. Bush recession started before they got here, blah, blah, blah. Really insignificant, especially a year from now when we'll be looking at midterm elections across the country. What they have to worry about is the fact that we all know that unemployment does not start declining until well into a recovery. this may be a very weak recovery. It may be a recovery that feels like a recession for folks. And if that number is bad, if we do reach finally that 10-digit number, which we do expect, I'm sorry, that 10%
we've been
number,
expecting it for a long time.
Yeah. Exactly. So we do expect
so they're lowering
that,
expectations.
Geithner was saying. Geithner was saying it. You know, they didn't expect it as long as economists have expected it. But definitely by the end of the year, we expect to be there. So it may be this Friday. And if that happens, then, you know, the kind of market rally that seems to have stopped after a seven-month run-up will probably really tank.
Well, it really tanked last week. Markham Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Adam Minot, BBC World Affairs correspondent. That's your agenda for this Monday morning. Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We're talking about elections. Tomorrow, nearly 380 cities, including Detroit and Atlanta, will elect a mayor. In New Jersey and Virginia, vote for governor. What's the big issue you're voting on in your local election tomorrow? Is it the economy, the war, health care?
This is Dan Malkiewicz from Bayside, New York, and I'm voting for the economy. I'm going to vote for Mike Bloomberg again.
And tell us what's driving your vote at 8778-MY-TAKE, and you can reach us at thetakeaway.org by email. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Afghan President Hamid Karzai will be in office for another term. The country's election commission declared him the winner this morning after Karzai's main rival, Abdullah Abdullah, withdrew from the election over the weekend. Joining us now is the BBC's Kabul correspondent, Andrew North. Andrew, do people in Afghanistan greet this news that Karzai is now the president and the whole election business is over with a sense of relief or some sort of suspicion that the whole thing's been rigged from the beginning?
I think relief is the main emotion among many people here and also among many Afghans, some disinterest because it's dragged on for so long. Yes, there will also be some suspicion over the whole business because it has there's been so much fraud, particularly in the first round. It was because of that fraud, these voting irregularities, that there was then to be a second round. But then when Dr. Abdullah pulled out of the race yesterday, in fact, saying that it was because there was not enough done to stop fraud, then it left just one man in the contest. And so ever since then, we have been expecting that the Afghan Election Commission would eventually find some means to cancel the runoff vote. And then now, as you know, President Karzai has been declared the winner.
So the appearance of an orderly transition of the, you know, one president to another, Karzai to Karzai. But does Abdullah Abdullah have the chance to live and fight another day, either in an electoral contest or as a member of the cabinet?
Well, we'll have to wait and see as to what happens with talks on forming a new government. That is possible. But right now, I think the questions are still going to be over the legitimacy of the process after it's been associated with so much fraud and now having to come up with this last-minute solution to call an end to what has been a very unhappy process for
Indeed.
Afghanistan's first second presidential elections.
And reporting live, the BBC's Kabul correspondent Andrew North with us from Kabul and the Obama administration, of course, considering its new strategy in Afghanistan over the next couple of weeks.
Okay, this afternoon we're going to get a government announcement on the H1N1 virus. Swine flu, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, along with the CDC, are going to hold an update briefing on the H1N1 virus. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Good morning, everyone. For our family segment, Lisa Belkin joins us. She writes the Family and Parenting blog for the New York Times. It's the Motherlode blog. She joins us from her home. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
Let's set the issue out clearly. Now, it's ideal that parents work as a team, moms and dads, in child rearing, but often what the dads do and what the moms do don't necessarily overlap. But as couples try to adjust things and maybe bring dads more into the child rearing, it turns out that a turf battle can result. Studies may say that dads should be more involved in child rearing, but the question is really whether moms are going to give their permission. Explain this turf battle issue.
Well, it's called gatekeeping, and I think that a lot of mothers don't even realize they do it. But the dynamic often starts early, and it's the, yes, I want you to be more involved, and yes, why the heck don't you take equal care of this child, but wait a second, do it my way phenomenon. And it takes all sorts of forms. In I mean, in my own family, my husband is a pediatrician. When my son was born, I had never held a baby before. And yet within hours, he was asking me questions. Is he hungry? Does he need to be changed? That I didn't know the answers to any better than he did. Frankly, he probably knew the answers better. But there's something in the zeitgeist, in the air, in the world that says, Mom knows. And it can screw up any attempts to make everything equal.
Well, let's get some practical advice on that score and welcome a couple of doctors onto the program. Doctors Kyle and Marcia Pruitt are co-authors of the new book, Partnership, Parenting, How Mothers and Fathers Parent Differently, Why It Helps Your Kids and Can Strengthen Your Marriage. So, Kyle and Marcia, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Was it a turf battle when Kyle decided to get more involved in raising your kids, Marcia?
I wouldn't exactly call it turf battle. What it is it's a complicated readjustment of each of your expectations. And it's less about who wants to run the show and more about how you agree how the show should be run. Because once you have kids, the odds, the importance of every decision just seems so intense compared to when you're doing it just the two of you.
So, Kyle, when did you get an impression that maybe Marcia had more rules about child rearing than you knew about?
Well, I thought it wasn't necessarily that she had a lot of rules, John. It was that she thought it was really her job.
Uh-huh.
And because she thought it was her job, she thought she better know the rules. But believe me, it was less of an issue for between Marcia and me than it was between me and the world. When I had my first children 30-plus years ago, I had to get assigned permission from the chair of obstetrics and gynecology to be in the room where my child was born,
wow.
Where I, as an intern, had been delivering babies 6 weeks ahead of that time.
Wow. Well, things have really changed.
Well, they've kind of changed, but I wish they'd changed more. When our latest child was born, she's just 10, we were in the sort of child care classes. Things were going well, and I noticed some other guys in the class, but there was this teenager whose baseball cap just got lower and lower over his eyes after week because nobody would talk with him. He was too shy to raise his questions himself, and the nurse never addressed him, and he eventually left. And I thought, wow, what a price to pay for institutions that have yet to get this picture that children really love both of their parents and need them.
So, Lisa Belkin, did gender roles complicate this here, or is there something that couples can use to help them work to share without running into some of these problems?
Yeah, no, we should say this is all going to be in a New York Times Science Section article tomorrow.
Right.
And it's not my article. It's Lori Tarkin's. And it's based on research of the Pruitts, who you're talking to, and the Cowans, who have done a lot of work in family relationships. And what they look at is that we have expectations within a relationship that we don't necessarily even know we've brought to it, and then you add the world, you add society's expectations, and it's hard to fight against. And then when we do, when parenting is looked at as a couple, parents do better and kids do better. But it's a surprisingly simple thing becomes a very tough fight. It becomes something you have to be conscious of every step of the way.
Well, Doctors Kyle and Marcia Pruitt, this sounds a little sort of sensitive guy, white, suburban. Does the research show that this actually is applicable across the board in families?
Absolutely it does. In fact, we are we are in the middle of a study in California called the Supporting Father Involvement, where we have been following over 500 families, including low-income Hispanic and African-American families. And we're finding that the intervention we've designed there to pull men closer into the family and protect children has been equally successful for lower and higher income, for different races and ethnicities, for people who are married and unmarried. We have now figured out some ways to engage fathers in ways that are healthy for couples of all different genres and styles, and that has trickle-down effects to the kids. The kids in the study, the control group kids, over the time we've studied them, have gotten more aggressive, more hyperactive, But the kids in our intervention, where the fathers have gotten more involved and the parents are working together, those kids have not developed those symptoms.
Huh. Well, Lisa Belkin, I guess the takeaway here is it's good to get parents to share the child rearing, but in the case of bringing fathers more into the picture, it doesn't happen naturally. You have to, adopt a mechanism to ensure that it's going to happen smoothly, right?
Well, there's a great line in the piece that says, fathers don't mother, they father, and you have to let them father.
Let fathers be fathers. Well, you'll find all about it in tomorrow's New York Times Science Times piece. Lisa Belkin writes the parenting blog for the New York Times, and Drs. Kyle and Marcia Pruitt, co-authors of the brand new book, Partnership Parenting, How Mothers and Fathers Parent Differently.
I bet you out there have lots of great stories on this topic. You can tell us about those at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But we're also talking about elections because people are going to be voting across the country tomorrow. You're going to be voting, and we're wondering what is taking you to the polls? What's got you fired up for election day tomorrow? What's going on in your local community? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also, actually, John, you may not know this, we have a newsletter now.
Well, help out our producer, Jim Colgan. He's writing this new newsletter for our the show, thetakeaway.org.
Right.
Right.
People
and
have asked for it.
You can
for
sign
updates.
Up for it. Yep.
Yeah, and you can sign up for it at thetakeaway.org.
And Colgan, you know, he's going to be a published author now with this newsletter, and we think it's really great for him. I'm
John
Hockenberry.
Look at it. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The dubious benefits of hindsight.
Not a damn human thinks that 50,000 or 100,000 or 150,000 are going to end that war. We're not getting out, but we're trying to hold what we got. And we're doing a bad, well, we're doing, we're losing at the rate we're going.
That's an agonized President Lyndon Johnson just before he decided to escalate the war in Vietnam into the military disaster it became. Lesson? Never deploy military means in pursuit of indeterminate ends. Voices from the rubble of Vietnam speak to the architects of America's war in Afghanistan. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, November 2nd. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we talk to Congressman Earl Blumenauer about how he feels about being labeled the death panel congressman. We're also going to talk to him about the stimulus and much more. And we'll also go to Maine. That could be the first state in the country to get a popular vote in support of gay marriage in tomorrow's election.
But first, Fatini Christia, MIT professor, guest of The Takeaway, expert in Afghan studies. Did you hear what I said a moment ago, Fatini? Does the Afghan war look at all to you like this lesson from Vietnam? Deploying military means in pursuit of indeterminate ends.
Frankly, unless there's a competent local partner on the ground, any move to add more troops will be in vain. We need President Karzai to change the way he governs before we move on with more troops.
And that's a story in and of itself. Stay with us, Fatini Christia from MIT. Gordon Goldstein, author of Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy, and the Path to War in Vietnam. If Fatini is right, then Afghanistan is Vietnam Act One at this point.
One of the problems is that when you engage in wars of counterinsurgency, historically you have a 1 in 4 chance of succeeding, and you never succeed without a competent, incredible, legitimate partner. So we are looking at a very ominous turn of events.
Gordon Goldstein, stay with us. History lessons and agonies for the Obama White House, but first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan has issued a statement congratulating Afghan President Hamid Karzai on winning a second term in office, winning in quotes there. He was declared the winner this morning by the country's Electoral Commission. Karzai's last remaining challenger, Abdullah, withdrew from the election over the weekend. Here at home, Ford Motor Company announced this morning it made nearly $1 billion in the third quarter. Ford says it now expects to be solidly profitable within the next 2 years.
Well, solidly in bankruptcy, meanwhile, the lender CIT Group has filed for bankruptcy. Bondholders have agreed to a reorganization plan that will reduce CIT's debt while allowing it to go on operating. In baseball, the Yankees are one game away from winning their 27th World Series. They beat the Phillies 7-4 last night. The next game is tonight. The Yankees lead the series 3-1. Wall Street, all major indices closed down at least 2.5% last week, but the Dow opens today at 97.13, the S&P opens at 10.36, and the NASDAQ kicks off at 20.45. Tomorrow is Election Day across the country. What's making news in your neck of the woods?
My name is David. I'm calling from Manhattan and voting for
Thompson, Bill Thompson. I'm of the opinion that you can't take millions and millions of dollars, refuse the federal government subsidies for election campaigns, and outspend an opponent and buy an election. That's not very democratic.
There's a taste of the New York mayoral race. What's going on in your neck of the woods? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. What do they say in the radio? No more calls. We have a winner.
We have a winner.
Hamid Karzai
right.
is officially the president of Afghanistan. The runoff election that was supposed to be held on Saturday
has been canceled.
Called off. And I was fiddling around with some archival sound over the weekend. And you're going to hear two voices in this next clip of tape. The first one is from John F. Kennedy back right. in 1963. The second voice is Abdullah Abdullah, the candidate in Afghanistan who withdrew. Listen and see if there's an echo from history here.
Monday, November 4th, 1963. Over the weekend, the coup in Saigon took place. I was shocked by the death of Zim and knew. I'd met Zim with Justice Douglas many years ago. He was an extraordinary character.
I repeat it once again that I will not participate in the November 7th elections.
Okay, let's bracket the history here. That's President JFK in the beginning there, back in 1963, just weeks before his own assassination, talking about a coup in Vietnam that brought down the Diem and Nu government, raising an issue of legitimacy of the Vietnam government as
Absolutely.
The U.S. was poised to increase its participation. And it's a tricky issue, legitimacy, and it was raised again 46 years later by the withdrawal of opposition leader Abdullah Abdullah from the runoff election in Afghanistan, where the U.S. is possibly poised for escalation in Afghanistan. President Hamid Karzai is officially the president. As we mentioned, the Election Commission has canceled the runoff. Gordon Goldstein, author of Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy, and the Path to War in Vietnam, is still with us. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning.
And our friend Fotini Christia, Afghanistan analyst and professor of political science at MIT, is also with us. Fotini, thanks for being a part of the program.
Thank you.
Now, what I wanted to do is often on the program, we sort of tiptoe around historical parallels between Vietnam and Afghanistan. But in honor of this book, Gordon Goldstein's Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy and the Path to the War in Vietnam, I think we want to confront them directly. You may have seen Goldstein on C-SPAN. He's given a lot of interviews about the book itself. But there are specific lessons here of those moments in 1963 and 1964 when the U.S. went from being a marginal player in Vietnam to being a huge intervener in Vietnam that are worth paying attention to. And Gordon, first of all, explain to me who McGeorge Bundy was and why he's important here quickly before we discuss Afghanistan.
McGeorge Bundy was the National Security Advisor to President Kennedy and President Johnson between 1961 and February 1966, and he was the president's principal foreign policy advisor on these strategy issues.
A brilliant man.
Former dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at the age of 34, and one of the leading intellectuals of his era.
And here's his voice in a conversation recorded in the White House of McGeorge Bundy speaking with Lyndon Baines Johnson about Vietnam.
What is your own internal thinking on this, Mr. President, that we've just got to stick on this middle course as long as there's any possible hope? And
I just can't believe that we can't take 15,000 advisors and 200,000 people and maintain the status quo for 6 months. I just believe we can do that if we do it right. Now, I don't know enough about it to know.
I don't.
That's from March 2nd, 1964. President Johnson and McGeorge Bundy are describing a possible decision to escalate in Vietnam. You can hear the ambivalence, the sense of, I don't know, do we do this? Do we not? Do we
do
this?
Will it work? Will it not?
Yeah, indeed. Fotini Christia, does that remind you of the kind of rhetoric you've been hearing out of the White House, or is there no parallel here?
No, there's definitely a fear of potential incrementalism in the context of Afghanistan. Some people say if you're going to do it, you have to give the general what he's asking, which is 40,000 troops. It's some sort of incremental middle between no extra troops and 40 is not going to work. So, yeah, a lot of this fear of incrementalism and insecure about how to proceed is there.
Gordon Goldstein, you were with McGeorge Bundy right up until his death working on what was going to be a memoir. It turned out not to be because he died before you could complete it. But he knew he was wrong. How did he get led into the Vietnam debacle, even though, as Fotini said, incrementally, you could see that the trends weren't great?
Well, at the time, he was not tracking the path of cause and effect of leading the United States to this incremental increase in troops. One of the things that's fascinating about the clip that you had is the reference to numbers. Today in Afghanistan, we have more than 250,000 American, allied, and Afghan troops. Most estimates suggest that the Taliban numbers no more than 25,000. We have a 10-to-1 numerical advantage. Despite that, though, General McChrystal is pushing for 40,000 additional troops. It's hugely problematic in these situations to augment what appears to be now a failing strategy.
A failing strategy. And that strategy in Vietnam was never explicitly discussed. One of the great things about this book is in the moments leading up to the decision to escalate, General Westmoreland thought this was a war of attrition in Vietnam, where you basically wear down the Viet Cong. But nobody else really had discussed it at all.
Yeah, this is a critical point. What Bundy observed about the deliberations that occurred in the summer of 1965, when the escalation was conceived and implemented, was this. He said, we argued about a number, not a use. We talked about the size of the troop increase, not the strategy that would govern it.
That's interesting.
And what is going on right now in the White House, I hope and believe, is that this president is arguing about and deliberating about a strategy rather than a number.
Fotini Christia at MIT, do you think this is a strategy of attrition, and do you think there's actual discussion of strategy? What would you make of the tea leaves that we're getting out of the White House?
I'm hoping there's a discussion on strategy. I mean, we are pretty clear about what 40,000 extra troops would mean in the sense of, you know, we have a number. But we hear a lot of discussion about withdrawal, but we have no sense of what that could possibly look like. Is it full withdrawal? Is it more civilian presence? Is it no civilian presence? And what are the implications if we were to go that route?
And, you know, you say, Fotini, I hope they're talking about strategy. But if you listen to the, you know, and today it's public, but it was secret back in 1964, the tone of President Johnson speaking with perhaps his most trusted advisor about Vietnam, you don't get a sense that the president got very good advice here. This is from, again, March 2nd, 1964.
I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me, we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere on in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It's an awful mess.
It's an awful mess, says McGeorge right. Bundy. The amazing thing about that clip, Celeste?
It could be today.
But he decided to escalate.
Exactly.
With all of that ambivalence, he decided to escalate. What did McGeorge Bundy do wrong in that critical moment, do you think?
Well, not to anticipate where this thing would end up. There was a decision made in 1965 when they sent in the first ground combat forces not to lose. There was not a corresponding decision to identify what would be a coherent and viable strategy to prevail. And the concern that I have looking at history is that we seem to be at a comparable place. I don't know if there is a viable strategy to win, quote unquote, win in Afghanistan, but there seems to be a tremendous momentum to augment this strategy so we don't lose.
Fotini Christia, listening to the tone of LBJ speaking with McGeorge Bundy, you know, 46 years later, convince me that we are not fated to just repeat the lessons of history, that we are not trapped by the institutions which make incremental decisions and, you know, thousands of troops will end up dying on the battlefield.
Part of me could feel like this could have been Dick Holbrooke saying this about the Afghan context and how everything is a mess. I think what people are realizing is that what we need to do is set up some basic requisite conditions that will enable us to leave. They just can't necessarily agree as to how we best need to go about this. I want to believe that the same mistake is not going to be repeated because these people that are making these decisions are still haunted by lessons of Vietnam. I mean, Holbrooke is very much aware of them. He keeps on referencing Vietnam in many contexts and instances in the Afghan situation. So I want to believe that it won't happen the same way it happened in Vietnam.
And it's not just leaders who are haunted. Listen to this clip from a media report in 1967, really essentially when the intervention in Vietnam was coming to its height.
December 1967. The campaign of North Vietnamese General Giap is going badly. He desperately needs a major victory. But the target he selects, Khe Sanh, hands him one of the costliest defeats of the war and gives the Allies spectacular confirmation that a ground battle can be won by air power.
We remember the siege of Khe Sanh now as a defeat, as an indication that the worst was coming in Vietnam. The media there thinking of it as a victory. Gordon Goldstein, take us out very, very quickly.
I think the question here is, where do you go with the strategy currently being considered as a strategy of counterinsurgency? It's open-ended. It's protracted. Where is the endpoint? Where is the terminus? It's entirely unclear to me.
Gordon Goldstein, authors of Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy, and The Path to War in Vietnam. Fotini Christia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Fotini Christia is Afghan analyst and professor of political science at MIT. 46 years later, eerie echoes of history.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, get your takeouts. Stories we want you to be on top of this week. And we begin with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So help me out here. When a big financial company blows up, it always seems to happen on the weekend. Why is that, Louise?
It's the worst part of a business journalist's job. It's like, what calamity will happen this weekend?
And this weekend's calamity is CIT. We've talked about them before.
Right?
Essentially, a bank to small and not so small businesses.
A lot of retailers.
Has gone bankrupt just as the holiday retail season is beginning. Yikes.
Yep. So what's happened? They've been struggling for a few months. They've been trying to avoid bankruptcy, but they couldn't. And so they're doing something known as a prepackaged bankruptcy, which they're hoping will let them smoothly get through this so they can keep lending to all the mid-sized retailers out there that really depend on them. But it's a big question because usually in finance with banks, if you file for bankruptcy, the wisdom is you're done. You're toast.
Yeah.
No one's going to work
right.
with you. So this will be a very interesting thing to see if you can really survive as a financial company where confidence is everything. If you can survive a bankruptcy.
Well, it's one thing to keep the lights on if you're bankrupt. It's quite another to actually continue to borrow money.
That's the problem. I mean, banking is about confidence. Borrowing is about confidence. And if people think CIT isn't really going to make it through, they won't help fund CIT's operations.
Well, who are these clowns that gave a CIT $2.3 billion?
Well, John, that's our money.
Oh, right. Oh, I see.
Taxpayer money. And we're already seeing in Washington a lot of pushback because we're losing the bailout money, the $2.3 billion put in CIT. It's gone.
So
we're
that
not
bankruptcy
getting it back.
Means this is gone.
That's it. We're not getting the money back. And so you've heard the politicians say that the bailout has been a good return with some companies like Goldman. It was not a good return with CIT. Over the weekend, we already saw politicians criticizing this, saying it's an indication that you shouldn't give the Fed more power and that you should end the bailout and all of these things. So this is definitely a black mark on the bailout.
Very quickly, are there alternative sources of credit for retailers gearing up inventories for the holiday season if CIT should just basically destruct?
So other banks do lend to retailers, but CIT is saying that the way they're doing this should allow retailers to keep on going. And remember, a lot of retail ordering is done in the summer before the holiday season. So a lot of it's already in place by now.
So maybe they've dodged a bullet. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times, talking about the CIT bankruptcy. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks. Let's move on to sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So, okay, after 7 division championships he gave the city of Green Bay, after 4 NFC champion games and 2 Super Bowl appearances, they won one. This is how the people of Green Bay greeted Brett Favre this weekend.
Here comes Brett Favre in the Minnesota offense.
But it clearly didn't seem to diminish his prowess on the field.
Favre's out of the shotgun. Adrian by his side. Takes the snap. Back to pass. Looking right. He pumps. Now he fires. Caught. Janko! Inside the ball. Touchdown!
The first of 4 touchdown passes for Favre. He beat his old team, the Packers, 38-26.
So let's run it back a little bit. Brett Favre was there for 16 years. Like you had said, he won a Super Bowl. He took them to the Super Bowl. But he also, at the waning part of his career a couple years ago, it was going back and forth. Should I play or should I not play? Should I play or should I not play? Aaron Rodgers was his understudy. He was coming up. The Packers felt that they had a great young quarterback in Aaron Rodgers, and they were like, well, if you don't stay, then we'll go with Aaron Rodgers. Eventually, he did not stay, and then they went with Aaron Rodgers. Brett Favre went to the Jets. They had a great early part of the season last year, and then he crumbled. His arm crumbled. He had to get surgery. Then it was another, should I stay or should I come? Should I stay? say it? Should I come? A little waffling back and forth. If he was a politician, he would not be a good one.
He's dithering, right?
Exactly. He's dithering. So then now he comes back. He plays for the Green Bay's
and
rival.
Trounces them.
Exactly. He beats them twice.
Yeah.
And the story yesterday was as much about the Vikings defense, which sacked Aaron Rodgers six times yesterday, which makes it, I mean, if Brett Favre was getting sacked six times, then the Vikings certainly wouldn't be winning 38-26. Another interesting part of it, there was a Racine paper. The Journal Times, a person was quoted, Stephen Bowser was quoted. He said, it was the most awkward cheering you'd ever hear. It was like being at a wedding with your ex-wife or something.
Oh,
because some people some people are rooting for Brett Favre and some people are cheering. It's a really difficult situation.
Weren't rooting right there. Let's check back in on some of the other games that you called last week. You said the Miami Dolphins would look good over the weekend.
Well, okay, yes. The Miami Dolphins, there was a seesaw game in the Meadowlands.
With
it was
the
like
Jets.
a pendulum swings left and right. But the most exciting part of the game with Miami Dolphins, they won 30-25. Ted Ginn Jr. ran back two kickoffs for a touchdown. And the Jets scored when they needed to keep the game close. But still, Miami has allowed 73 points in the fourth quarter, but not this game. They stopped the Jets.
Giants got stomped.
The Giants, it was disgusting. The pass
it
rush.
It was disgusting. There's your takeaway.
The Giants were having their own November massacre in the first quarter, showcasing all the holes in their secondary and the weakness of their pass rush. The Eagles, Donovan McNabb, the quarterback, picked apart the Giants' defense the way the Phillies wish Cole Hamels had done in game three.
And finally, very, very quickly, you said that the Detroit would probably beat the awful St. Louis Rams.
I did say that.
You got my hopes up.
And it didn't happen, and I feel sorry for the city of Detroit, I'm rooting for Matthew Stafford because he's going to be the reincarnation of Troy Aikman.
Okay.
But Detroit has a tradition to uphold, though, of losing, right?
That's enough out of you over there. Cut his mic, please. That's a Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Good morning.
So our last takeout is a pile of receipts from listeners. Last week we were following the money, federal stimulus money, and one trail led to Michigan.
This is Alex Campbell from Sterling Heights, Michigan. I have just got a new job 3 months ago, so my job was created because of the stimulus package. It's with a construction company. Thankfully, I have a job now. It doesn't pay much, but it's better than nothing.
Karen noticed this in her own neighborhood. She emails, our regional electrical and gas utility just announced a stimulus grant of $84 million to install smart meters. They send your usage directly to the company. The advantage to the consumers is the company will know if your power's out even if you're not home, and dozens or maybe even hundreds of meter readers, though, are out of work now. There's going to be people employed short-term to install the meters, but all those people who read those meters, gone forever. What about that is stimulating, Karen emails?
Temporary jobs there. Randy in Union, Oregon emails us. There is yet a job to be had here in Oregon. As a resident in the rural part of the state, it seems that it's taking an unusually long time for the stimulus funds to result in any local work. Our communities faced plant closures in the manufacturing and timber industries. The holiday season's potential for employment seems to be a dry hand, too.
And the whole auto bailout chaos turned out to be a stimulus for more than just bankruptcy lawyers. The economic headlines turned out to be a job finder for this Michigan listener.
Due to the arranged merger between Chrysler and Fiat and the assistance from the government, I was able to get a job because of that program, working on a joint program between the two companies.
Well, congratulations to that listener. And call Duncan's story here a case of trickle-up economics. I took advantage of the clean burn tax credits to buy a new Jetta diesel. I had not planned to buy a new car this year. My intent was to hold off one more year, but given the incentive and a desire to feed whatever money I could to the economy, thanks for that, Duncan, I jumped early. However, I'm not sure this really qualifies as beneficial stimulus because I now, of course, have an auto loan to repay.
We can't do anything about that, yeah. Duncan, but keep the responses coming at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Congressman Earl Blumenauer is going to talk about how everyone supported end-of-life counseling until it started getting called death panels. That, the stimulus package, bikes, and more. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. The U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan has issued a statement congratulating Afghan President Hamid Karzai on winning a second term in office. He was declared the winner this morning by the country's Electoral Commission. Karzai's last remaining challenger, Abdullah Abdullah, withdrew from the election over the weekend. Here at home, Ford Motor Company announced this morning it made nearly $1 billion in the third quarter. Ford says it now expects to be solidly profitable within the next 2 years. We'll have more than that in a few minutes.
Meanwhile, the lender CIT Group has filed for bankruptcy. Its stock is tanking this morning, although Wall Street, open within the last couple of minutes, is undergoing a bit of a rally after a terrible week last week. Bondholders at CIT, meanwhile, have agreed to a reorganization plan that will reduce the company's debt while allowing it to go on operating. Pentagon auditors have told a chief contractor in Iraq to cut its workforce there or face heavy fines. The Pentagon says the contractor, KBR, has increased its employee levels in Iraq, even though U.S. forces are leaving the country. KBR says it disagrees with the results of the audit. In Europe, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says he will appear at his trial in The Hague tomorrow. He's facing charges of genocide. And in sports, the Yankees are one win away from clinching the World Series. They beat the Phillies 7-4 last night to win Game 4. They now lead the series 3-1. Game 5 is tonight in Philadelphia. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says we're going to get a vote on the House version of the health care reform bill this week. And meanwhile, we got a preliminary scorecard from the Congressional Budget Office. It estimates the plan is going to cost over $1 trillion over the next decade. That's far above the $829 billion cost that Democrats had come up with. And that's above the target point that President Obama had set as well. We're going to talk about that now with Congressman Earl Blumenauer. He's a Democrat serving Oregon's 3rd District. That includes Portland. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
So we get this news from the Congressional Budget Office saying that it's going to cost more than $1 trillion over the next decade. Does that mean this health care bill in the House needs to be trimmed down?
Not necessarily. First of all, in terms of where we're going with health care costs in this country, Medicare costs are out of control. It's the biggest single threat to fiscal stability in the future. And individuals are seeing the health care costs for their companies, their individuals, skyrocketing. So if we do nothing, we're in really big trouble. Additionally, there are elements in this bill that in the long term are actually going to reduce cost. The CBO is very rigorous in terms of how they analyze that. But you look at what we're doing, I think it's going to make a big difference. And I think the American people want some progress in this front.
We also heard from the Congressional Budget Office that just about 2% of the population would use the public option. Should that change support for this public option? Does that change the argument for including it?
Well, I think it is in many parts of the country. Having at least the choice of a public option is going to inject an element of competition into the process. In half the states, one company has 50% of the market or more. And at least having the choice for a public option, I think, is going to inject a little bit of competitive tension. The overarching solution, but I think it's part of a comprehensive approach that will make a difference.
Okay, so you proposed a provision into the health care bill that ended up, you're laughing
coming.
Already, that ended up causing a lot of controversy.
Well, let me just be specific about some things that I've been hearing lately.
Adolf Hitler called his program the final solution. I kind of wonder what we're going to call our.
This is being read as saying every 5 years you'll be told how you can die.
The vicious assault on elderly people.
I don't want the government to do it for me.
I guess everybody got your message.
Yeah, Earl Blumenauer, you were proposing a vicious assault on elderly people. You proposed what ended up being called death panels, but it was actually counseling sessions on end-of-life care.
We are dealing with a situation that for many people today, there is a default option that sometimes is very aggressive treatment, which may or may not be what people want. And what I had proposed and actually had unanimous support on our Ways and Means Committee was paying physicians to counsel people who wanted it, and it would be their own physician, in terms of what they could expect in end-of-life situations for individuals and their family. It is benign. It's important. Every rational observer agrees that this is something we should be doing. We wouldn't have had that bizarre Terry Schiavo spectacle, for instance, if they had had that sort of conversation.
But do you support the government being a part of that counseling?
Well, all we're doing here is having the government pay for you to choose your health professional. The government right now will pay to hook you up on any machine, give you tests, probes, tubes. It wouldn't pay a few dollars for a physician to sit down and talk to people for half an hour. That's ludicrous.
Can I ask you a question about competition?
Absolutely.
You said that if there is a public option in this bill, it would inject competition into the marketplace that would perhaps reduce costs. If that's true, how come the presence of Medicare and Medicaid, the huge public option and the huge intervention that the government has made into healthcare, hasn't produced cost savings? It's rising as steeply as it ever has.
Well, part of the difference here is that Medicare is very structured in terms of payment reimbursement. And it's not to say that it hasn't had an effect in some communities. I think, in fact, it does in terms of providing choice, in terms of providing volume. This would be something that would be negotiated on an individual basis and be one more element.
You know, one of the things that's most recognizable to you, perhaps from people who are not, you know, familiar with the congressional delegation of Oregon, is the fact that you bike to work in Capitol Hill. You've got a bright green bike pin coming up. And I'm wondering, one of the things that's been stalled in Congress is the transportation bill. Are we ever going to get some movement on this? You've said a lot about how the transportation in Portland, their light rail and the streetcars work very well. How do we get the transportation bill out of committee?
Well, part of the problem is that we don't have a funding mechanism in place. Right now, we can only finance about $230 billion for the next 6 years. If we just do what we're doing now, it will cost over $300 billion, and it's nowhere near what we need to have going forward. I listened to your segment about the economic stimulus, the most important economic stimulus, providing family wage jobs and improving the environment and productivity around the country would be to fund that in a robust fashion. And we're working hard to provide the funding mechanisms to break that bill loose.
Very quickly, would you vote for a second stimulus package?
I would, personally, but I don't think we need to do that. If we adequately fund infrastructure for transportation, for water, for Superfund cleanup, I think that is the best economic stimulus we can do going forward.
I've got clinch your tires on my wheelchair. Do you have a double-stroke bicycle pump with you? Do you? I might need to fill my... You don't?
He didn't bike in today,
nailed
John.
You.
He didn't
we
bike
nailed
in.
You.
Representative
guilty.
Earl Blumenauer, Democrat representing Oregon's in 3rd District that includes Portland. Thanks so much for being with us.
Cheap shot, John.
That's me, babe.
We're going to talk about the gay marriage proposal in Maine that could have some history-making potential.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now is Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, an online magazine covering the auto industry. And Paul, good morning.
Good, John. Good morning.
You know, there was a time in the many decades I've known you as a reporter covering the auto industry where reporting on Ford Motor Company being $27 billion in debt and having only made $1 billion profit in the third quarter would be a huge negative story. But it is the happiest story on Wall Street and possibly the happiest story in a year for the auto industry. What happened?
Well, it's a surprise, isn't it? This billion-dollar number exceeded even the most optimistic expectations about where Ford would go. Ford is a curious company. They were the only ones of the domestic makers to skip a bailout last year, and they have been saying that they are, quote-unquote, a different type of car company. Well, guess what? They seem to be proving it. What's really significant about this one isn't that they made $1 billion. You know, they made some money earlier this year, but most of that was from all sorts of one-time charges and write-offs and all this. They made a lot of money in North America, where nobody has been making money. Even Toyota's had problems in the last year.
Right. Well, let's talk about the supposition from company officials is that we've changed our company. It's a new Ford Motor Company. Actually, one of your colleagues in the Detroit market there was talking about how Ford actually has managed to change itself essentially overnight. Do you buy it?
Not to that degree. Yeah, Ford has done a lot. Bringing in Alan Mulally, who was one of the senior managers at Boeing 3-odd years ago, has certainly helped. He has forced the company to think about doing things a different way than it used to do, and it is definitely paying off. But this is a company that has a peculiar politics internally, and they are still struggling to try to get rid of some of the problems that they had over the years. So they have some challenges ahead of them, but they're certainly better off than GM and Chrysler.
And
now,
of course,
you want to hear the dark side.
Let's hear the dark side. Yep.
Okay. The dark side is that doing well could cause them to do badly going forward. Over the weekend, we pretty much determined that the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, has rejected demands for concessions from Ford Motor
right.
Company that would give it the same sort of cost cuts that that GM and Chrysler have gotten. And that's going to be a problem going forward.
So all of its advantages are suddenly going to look like disadvantages if labor tensions increase. Finally, you know, there's a lot of talk about changing management within Ford, but, I mean, ultimately, American carmakers have to make automobiles that are relevant to the times, both environmentally, in terms of fuel economy, and the design challenges. Is Ford managing really to do that?
Ford is getting some real kudos, and that's the critical thing, for the product. Consumer Reports, which many critics say is import-friendly, called Ford the only world-class manufacturer of high-quality, dependable vehicles when they announced their annual auto dependability study just last week. J.D. Power is saying the same thing. Ford's gotten a lot of kudos, for example, for the Fusion Hybrid, which is actually getting 4 miles a gallon better than the Toyota Camry Hybrid. So they're getting a lot of good play for making some darn good products lately.
And they did it all without a cent of bailout money. They owe creditors when they took their line of credit out before the recession hit. But that move, which seemed disastrous at the time, looks like a brilliant move now. Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com online magazine covering the auto industry, reporting on Ford's billion-dollar profit announcement. Thanks, Paul.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. We're going to be talking about elections a lot because elections are happening tomorrow. 380 cities, including Detroit and Atlanta, are going to elect a mayor. A governor's race is in New Jersey and Virginia. But we're wondering what's on the ballot in your area, what's going to drive you to the polls tomorrow, and what's getting you fired up about the elections. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. President Hamid Karzai has been declared the winner of Afghanistan's presidential election. Afghanistan's Electoral Commission announced the decision this morning. It's after Karzai's only opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, withdrew over the weekend.
Here in the U.S., the automaker Ford had a pretty good third quarter, but the lender CIT Group has filed for bankruptcy. Here's economist Peter Morisi's take on it.
CIT's bankruptcy indicates the financial sector is still on shaky ground. Although Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, the recipient of large amounts of federal largesse, are doing very well, the regional banks that haven't gotten the attention from Washington they need are in very bad shape.
Bad shape, but still operating at least. Bondholders have agreed to a reorganization plan that will reduce CIT's debt while allowing it to go on lending. Ford's positive news and CIT's negative news are moving the market this morning. After a bit of a rally at the open, Wall Street is now about flat from where it was last week after losing 2.5%. President Obama meets today with his economic advisory board to discuss job creation. It's only the second time he's met with that group. And in just a moment, we'll be talking about the choices Maine voters face on same-sex marriage. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are pondering the same issue as well. The D.C. City Council will hold a second hearing today to consider a bill that would allow same-sex marriage. Looking ahead to later today, the Yankees could clinch their 27th World Series if they win tonight in Philadelphia. The team beat the Phillies 7-4 last night in Game 4. They now lead that series 3-1. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We are deeply concerned about the institution of marriage itself.
We will get marriage equality for all Mainers.
Opponents of Question One say that legalizing homosexual marriage has nothing to do with schools.
But it has everything to do with schools.
You may disagree, but people have a right to live how they want to live.
Gay marriage on the ballot again tomorrow in Maine. Well, again, on national headlines anyway. It's going to be on the ballot in Maine. Both sides of the issue are trying to learn lessons from the Proposition 8 battle in California. If Maine upholds marriage for same-sex couples, this will be the first time that voters have chosen to support the gay marriage movement. 30 states have voted against gay marriage, and in the states where gay marriage is legal, that's been done through the courts and through the legislature, not through the voters. Here to explain what all this is about tomorrow, we have Abby Goodenough, the Boston bureau chief for the New York Times, who's been covering the story. Good morning, Abby.
Hi, how are you doing?
So from what I understand, especially in terms of people who are donating to the fight over gay marriage in Maine, people are really drawing connections between this vote tomorrow in Maine and the vote in California over Proposition 8 that outlawed gay marriage.
Right. There's a lot of parallels in the strategies that both sides are using. That fight just took place just a year ago, so a lot of the people who helped out with that had come to Maine and are lending all their support and advice there. And they really hope that after that big defeat in California last year that Maine can be a victory, the supporters of gay marriage anyway.
How is it looking? How is it looking? How's the
it's
vote looking?
Very, very close. I think one of the latest polls last week had the gay marriage supporters very slightly ahead, but polls on gay marriage are known to be really unreliable. So it's really unclear at this point who's going to win. Everybody's saying it's going to be extremely close, and turnout is going to be the crucial thing.
Okay, we're joined now by a couple stakeholders in this argument. Shenna Bellows is executive director of ACLU Maine and the member of the executive committee of Protect Maine Equality. We're also joined by Brian Suchet, campaign spokesman for Stand for Marriage Maine. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Brian, let's go to you first. The public relations consulting firm that helped out in California to defeat gay marriage there is actually helping you as well, correct?
That is correct.
The same firm?
Yes.
And what tack are you taking there? I mean, what is your argument against gay marriage in Maine?
Well, I think it's not an argument against gay marriage in Maine, per se. I think it's an argument for marriage, period. And this is everywhere. The issue is the same. The arguments are going to remain the same. I think you're going to see the same arguments no matter what state you go to. This is about preserving traditional marriage and the benefits to children, the benefits for having moms and dads in their lives. And the issues aren't going to change no matter where you go.
Your Stand for Marriage group is supported very strongly by the Roman Catholic Church, correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
And yet it's interesting to note that Maine has been listed as one of the top three least religious states in the country.
That is also true.
Is that working against you?
Well, I mean, it's no surprise that particularly GLAAD, they have an objective of getting all six states in New England to have homosexual marriage by 2012. I think part of the secularism is the reason why they've tried to do this in the New England region. Because they're hoping, I believe, that secularism will lend itself towards embracing what we consider a radical redefinition of marriage. But so far, it's only been able, as you put out, to be done through the state legislatures and the judges. So we'll see what the people have to say.
Okay, well, let's talk about secularism. Let's go to Shenna Bellows, the executive director of ACLU Maine, also member of the executive committee of Protect Maine Equality. So we just heard cavalcade of voices at the top of this. We just heard someone saying, you may disagree, but people have a right to live how they want to live. And that's kind of a different strategy on the gay marriage issue, where you're using an argument of just let people be as they want to be. Is that working?
We think so. Mainers value fairness and equality. And in Maine, it's not 6 degrees of separation. It's 1 or 2, which is why we have been focused on a neighbor-to-neighbor, friend-to-friend campaign talking about the importance of marriage equality and the importance of live and let live.
Okay, so Abby, let's talk about the funding here. Abby Goodenough, the Boston bureau chief for the New York Times. We've been hearing a lot that the support for the gay marriage initiative is far stronger financially than that for Stand for Marriage Maine, the group that Brian's with.
When the last financial filings came out, which was just over a week ago, they had raised, I believe, about twice as much, maybe not quite that much, on the pro-gay marriage side. I'm sure there's been a lot of financial activity and contributions in the last 8 days, and it could have changed, but yeah, looking aggressively both out-of-state and in-state for contributions. And last we heard, I think it was $4.2 million that had been raised by the pro-marriage side, and about $2.6 million for the anti-marriage side.
Brian Suchet, campaign spokesman for Stand for Marriage Maine. Are you married, sir?
Yes, I am.
How does a gay couple getting married, either in your neighborhood or in your state, affect your marriage?
It doesn't affect my marriage personally. I've never claimed that. But what it does affect, and this is the important part, is the society that I live in. If we want strong families, we feel that mothers and father matters. Mothers and fathers matter in the lives of children. There is only one.
I understand that, but does your family get less strong in some sense if gays are allowed to get married in Maine?
My family stands as it does based on its own merits and what me and my wife bring to our family. Just like a gay couple right now as we speak, their family stands strong based on what they bring to their family. I'm not sure how marriage is going to change how strong a gay family is, but what it does do is affect marriage and society for the rest of us.
All right, Shana Bellows, very quick question. It sounds like your campaign is soft-spoken in the sense that if you were to go much bigger and higher profile in this referendum, that you would run the risk of having this be shot down like what happened in California and essentially enshrining gay marriage as being illegal in the state of Maine. Are you worried about that?
We're not worried about it here in Maine. We heard stories from hundreds of gay and lesbian couples here in Maine who are denied the over 400 legal rights, benefits, protections, and responsibilities with civil marriage. Stories like two men, one who literally donated a portion of his liver to his partner but was not covered by his partner's health insurance for the procedure because they were not married. We have been sharing those stories across the state. We think marriage does strengthen families and protect children, and that's why we should end discrimination.
Okay, Shana Bellows is Executive Director of ACLU Maine and member of the Executive Committee of Protect Maine Equality. We also heard from Brian Suchet, campaign spokesman for Stand for Marriage Maine, and Abby Goodenough, the Boston Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
Well, you really get a feel for what the debate is like in Maine, and there are places all around the country that are having debates about various issues and candidates and the election tomorrow. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods. Or my take at thetakeaway.org. If you missed any of the show today, particularly a great conversation we had earlier this morning looking at the parallels between Vietnam and Afghanistan, Fotini Christia and Gordon Goldstein joined us. You can find it on our podcast at thetakeaway.org. You can subscribe. You can get our new newsletter that our producer Jim Colgan is writing. And Colgan, you know, this is a big start for him.
It is. This could be the beginning of his book tour.
Big launch for the newsletter. Okay, it's at thetakeaway.org. And again, what's going on in your neck of the woods, local politics. Politics is all local. 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story or my take at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This, of course, is a Monday morning takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.